but I feel like sleeping is the worst way.
Ryan, you are mortal. One day you are going to die. Every hour beyond now is more precious than the last.
I'll sleep when I'm dead.
No. Hi, everybody. I'm Jim.
I'm Ryan.
And this is the Concept Crucible Podcast.
And today, we go back to our philosophical route.
Don't speak English today, do you?
I don't. We've been working hard. We go back to our philosophical roots to talk about ethics. Actually, that's more apropos because we're going to be talking about the origin of our ethics, which is the roots of our ethics.
So I thought that's where you were going with that whole sentence.
No, I'm making this up as I go.
Oh my God.
So not only do we go back to the root of our training and how our relationship started, but we're also going to go back. It's like an inception of rooting.
Stop talking. Icebreaker.
Okay.
What is an ethical position that you have rejected?
So this one, when you posed it, it was a weird and interesting one because I haven't quite rejected it outright. I've kind of consented to rejecting it, but there's still, it has its claws in my mind. Mm. And that has to do with understanding. Okay, so the original position was that philosophy is a dispassionate examination of ideas. Much in the same way, science is a dispassionate look at the world. Right? That's the original position. And I realized
that... For those of you who are listening, I'm shaking my head right
now. Yeah, yeah. And I realized that that works to a degree, but it does not work in certain specific examples. And recently, with the news and whatnot, with philosophers who deal with racial identity and racial experience, mm-hmm. and queer theory, and specifically... trans philosophy and trans philosophers, and I realize that objective, we can talk about anything, is not exactly a good position to have. And I recognize that, and there's still some elements that I haven't quite been able to shake off for myself. Like, for example, the discussion of ideas as violence. Mm-hmm. I understand the general gist of it, especially because I understand that ideas lead to action, or that ideas are not in a vacuum when a person has been experiencing or has been marginalized their entire life and experiences oppression. I understand that, but I suppose my disconnect is I understand it on an intellectual level, but not on a lived level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where that tension is the original position of dispassionate philosophy is not a one-size-fit-all thing, but it still works its way into my thinking and causes some issues when I'm trying to learn about things that are outside of my experience.
Fair. There's a whole bunch of unpacking that goes on in there with, mm-hmm. The notion that ideas themselves. I mean, for example, like the notion that we could dispassionately debate the legitimacy of a person's existence,
mm-hmm.
Or a person's right to exist. The dispassionate, objective, arguably fake version of philosophy that says that's okay has problems. I mean, because there are things that shouldn't be up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mere act of having that debate or having that discussion further marginalizes people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the classic of explain to me why it's okay that you're queer.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm not going to say is a discussion I've never had.
Hmm.
And it's just, you're just like, what, where does that even start? Like, we've already made a bunch of really shitty assumptions.
Yeah.
An ethical position that I have rejected, I had a couple, but sort of dovetails with yours, is the notion that it is necessary to understand something to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
I did a video on this, I think, last year. We'll throw in the show notes. But, I mean, the basics of it, again, like dovetailing with things like identity theory and queer theory, is that it is not necessary, when someone needs your support, someone is doing a difficult thing, it is not necessary for you to understand that thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is necessary for you to accept that thing. I talked about it in the context of coming out, mm-hmm. and the idea that people are like, oh, well, this is a new identity and a new version of you, and it's going to take me a while to understand it, and they use that as grounds for invalidating that identity, mm-hmm. when in fact it is not new. The knowledge to them is simply new, mm-hmm. and it is what is necessary is not that they understand it. The people are perfectly happy to use airplanes and phones and cars without understanding them. Mm-hmm. It is unreasonable to expect that of people, but it's also just generally sort of good critical thinking practice to accept. As weird as it sounds, but like one of the classic moves in a discussion is to grant things for the sake of argument. Mm-hmm. So it seems equally easy to go, okay, well, let's grant that everything that you have reported about literally your own identity that only you could know about is true, mm-hmm. given that you're the only authority on it. Mm-hmm. Now what? Mm-hmm. And the answer, you know, they're like, are there like negative consequences, maybe, is a question that you might ask. And the answer is no, and also kind of who cares. Mm-hmm. It's a position with room for a lot more nuance than I really... Mm-hmm. can get into an icebreaker, mm-hmm. but it is one that I've left behind, that notion of understanding is necessary. Mm-hmm. The world contains in it more identities than I can fit in my head.
Yeah.
But I can still hang out with those people.
Yeah.
Without giving them a fucking hard time. So, yeah, the way that we wanted to do this was dig into not just the theoretical bits on where, I mean, because we both wrote graduate papers and graduate degrees in ethics, mm-hmm. and on very different portions of it, because you did rescue ethics, right?
Yeah, ethics and first aid and helping yeah. people in emergencies,
and I wrote on stakeholder ethics, mm-hmm. and the sort of the developing best practices with regard to the moral imagination. Mm-hmm. A bunch of other weirdo things. So maybe we'll start at the beginning.
Yeah.
So early ethical influences, like where did you, Ryan the person, mm-hmm. Learn to do the right thing as a little tiny Ryan? Perhaps the tiniest of Ryans.
The tiniest.
Perhaps not. You're quite large.
The tiniest that I've ever been, mm-hmm. I guess. So I have the uncontroversial origins of, you know, parents, grandparents, teachers, but I think the one that stands out more, the more I think about it, the more I realize that it did have an impact, is... We've talked about it before. I think we've mentioned it before. Is Power Rangers?
Yeah, we've almost certainly mentioned it before.
Yeah, I mean Power Rangers, and I guess if you want to go something a little bit less goofy, although I don't think it's when I say that less goofy, I mean like Spider-Man, for example, with great power comes great responsibility. But I think Power Rangers articulated it a little bit differently, but had the same kind of messaging behind it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I was conscious of this, or that I like wrote out Zordon's three laws of Power Rangers.
Can you, for reference, what are the three laws?
So,
because I don't remember.
Yeah, so Zordon, when the Rangers became Rangers in the first episode, and even in the movie it was referenced, there were three canonical laws that Zordon lays out for the Rangers.
Zordon Lightfoot.
First, you must keep your identity a secret. And of course, if you're like incredibly skeptical listening to this, you're going to be like, obviously, these are things to keep the narrative going. Yes, totally. I understand that. But the idea, he says, keep your personal identity, or keep your identity as a secret. So, okay, whatever. The second one's where things start to get more interesting. Never use your powers for personal gain.
Mm.
And I think that's in an extended sense, because that's not to say like you shouldn't use your talents to be able to profit from them. He's saying that you're getting these fantastic abilities. Don't use them to, you know, get yourself fame or glory. or any kind of personal motivation that way. Mm. It's always meant for a kind of greater good. Or your powers are used in proportionate to the good that they produce. And then the third one, and this one is perhaps one that actually has carried forward in time, is you never escalate a battle until, in this case, Rita escalates it. And of course, again, this is a storytelling thing because it makes sense why the Rangers didn't just drag out the Megazord at the first sign that there was a villain and curb stomp the hell out of it.
Yeah, at the same time, though, like, you have grown from a tiny little Huckle
mm-hmm.
into a person who arguably professionally de-escalates things.
Yeah, and that's why I say it's probably the one that's carried forward in time, and it's a thing that I value as a security guard, that we exhaust any other alternative. You know, like, formally speaking, it's called the use of force wheel, or the influence wheel. Basically, you start off with, you know, really soft persuasion, and then you escalate it from there. You don't escalate it up until full force until it's absolutely required. Even then, sometimes it's not required that you use full force. You know, mostly it should be more of a defensive thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the stereotype of the bouncer that, you know, they tell you to do something, you don't comply, and so they throw a punch, is something that's not accepted at our bar. And so that idea that, you know, you don't, you know, from a bullying point of view as a child, you know, you don't solve your problems by immediately resorting to force and violence. You mm-hmm. find other ways of doing it. It's, again, it's not something that, you know, like, when I was bullied, that I thought about. I was actually a fairly easygoing temperament, so I was bullied more often than, well, I should say, I remember being bullied more often than I consciously remember bullying people, which is not mm-hmm. to say I didn't bully people, but when I was more likely to be picked on because I was shy and introverted and whatnot. But that idea that you don't escalate, you don't immediately jump to the last possible resort, has kind of stuck with me over time. And then when I drifted away from Power Rangers, and then I came back to Power Rangers as an adult, and I was acquainted with the three laws, I just was blown away by how amazing and well-crafted, perfect they were in terms of a good lesson. Like, yeah, basically, when I thought about this, I said, if I had to pick a medium, or if I had to pick a media thing to sit my child down in front of to learn lessons from, Power Rangers would probably be on that list.
Fair? I don't know that that's how parenting works.
I know that's not what Sarah's going to let me do.
But
if I was a single parent, it would definitely be, here's Power Rangers.
I still don't think that's how parenting works. But I'm not an expert. I, as a child, did use force and violence to achieve all my ends. I had really, I did not have a really well-developed sense of, like, empathy or human relationships or anything like that. I had a lot of behavior problems and ethical problems, and I made a point of whenever adults would try and teach me a lesson, I would learn the exact opposite lesson. We talked about it in the pre-show where, I mean, I was punished all the time as a kid. You know, by everybody from my parents to schools to every once in a while the police. And the lesson that I took away from that was learn to not fear punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which is not the lesson that they were attempting to impart.
Mm-hmm.
But is a learnable lesson from that. And once you are a child who does not fear punishment, the capacity for, not just for acting out, but the capacity for, like, damaging other human beings and your relationships with them grows dramatically in a way that I'm not particularly proud of.
Mm.
But if I were to look for, like, sort of early influences on my ethics... I mean, you sort of, like, skipped over parents,
mm-hmm.
Which I find really interesting, given your sort of, like, really close relationship with your family,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that the, like, probably the center of my ethical universe, at least as a child, was my mom. My mom is a woman of, like, towering moral character. And especially when I was a kid, you know, there was a constant emphasis on practicing compassion, on recognizing like the dignity of others, on being the same person in front of people that you are behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And I remember sort of witnessing all of these lessons, but not learning anything from them until much later. Mm-hmm. But in the sense of, like, you know, we made a point of helping out neighbors. Mm-hmm. And being part of the community, whatever that meant. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent a lot of time as a kid volunteering. And I don't know how much of that was like actually teach your kid a lesson and whatnot. Lessons I wouldn't learn until much, much later in life.
Yeah.
But, and how much of that is again, just like my mom being the person that she is. Mm-hmm. But it is in it is interesting to see that reflected now, like, in my adult values. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have a lot of influences from, like, TV. Mm-hmm. and books and media. Like, I probably do, but nothing that I can really pin down. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a lot of friends, shockingly. The exception being one kid who also sort of had like a strong sense of ethics and timing, because his mom was much like mine. Mm-hmm. And we got along famously. He was much more, I remember as a kid, he had a much better grasp of like other people. Like he was much, much more like socially adept than me, and I spent a bunch of time. I probably spent equal amounts of time, like, resenting him for that, but also like trying to learn. Mm-hmm. 'Cause he was just generally much more pleasant. Mm-hmm. But so I mean, early ethical influences, I think that that it's really hard to get away from the foundation of your morality. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a big shocker to find that your current ethical position, like, almost always, like, regardless of whether you're you know, a full professor philosopher, or, you know, somebody who hasn't thought about it until listening to this podcast, I don't think it's that weird to find out that what you learned early on, mm-hmm, pretty much agrees with what you think now. Mm-hmm. Only now you have the advantage of like adding more nuance to it and understanding that, like, life is complicated and it throws a lot of weird situations at you. Like, Power Rangers doesn't deal a lot with complicated ethical dilemmas.
Not that I can remember.
You know, there are a few. Like, yeah. What do we do about Tommy?
Yeah.
And how come he's evil sometimes? But, I mean, you know, or how do we deal with this responsibility? Mm-hmm. But those are, I mean, they're certainly not the same as, you know, dealing with ethical dilemmas regarding work or finances or, mm-hmm, personal relationships, or even just common action. Mm-hmm. Because those characters don't experience those kinds of dilemmas.
No. It is a kid's show. It's,
yeah.
We don't need to overload
I don't know. Avatar does it really well.
I'm not entirely sure it was a kid's show, though.
What, Avatar?
Yeah.
Oh, Avatar's totally a kid's show.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Avatar does it really well. I mean, admittedly, it has the advantage of being, almost 30 years later, mm-hmm, 20 years later. So, you know, we've learned a lot about sort of writing and writing for TV and things like that. But Avatar does a whole bunch of, like, here's a problem that actual kids have. Mm. Okay, well, here's them having a conversation about how to address this problem in a way that's useful. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, the standard, we deal with it indirectly and then learn a lesson and then close on a laugh. It's really good at, like, you know, let's take a situation that kids experience and show them, like, give them an example of how to have a hard conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really cool about it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the current state of your morality? Yeah, what do you like? What's your ethical motivation now? Like, how does that? I mean, obviously, you're a filthy virtue ethicist.
Yeah,
as we've noted, we'll throw it in the show notes.
Yep, yep. Everything in the name of my patron Aristotle.
Oh my god. No. You get. You've earned your due.
Yeah, I suppose. I'm trying to remember where we were going with this in the pre-show. I mean, I know that my sense of morality has shifted in the last, say, 5 years, and I don't want to say it was exclusively you, but I started hanging around, or I started associating more closely with different kinds of people. Which
no, I'll take credit.
Yeah, with different, it exposed me to different things outside of my experience, which shifted things around. But I'm trying to draw a blank of how we wanted to proceed with this section of the podcast.
So maybe I'll take that line of questioning first then.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time during my thesis thinking about intersubjective facts.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, I mean, because we spend a lot of time in general thinking of ethics as relative. And I don't know that I buy that it's relative. I buy that it's contextual.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that those are different things.
Yeah.
Like, we can have meaningful conversations about, you know, what we should do in any given situation.
Mm-hmm.
Based on certain considerations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, he taught my business ethics course, Kurt. And the magic phrase of "we should do X in virtue of Y,"
mm-hmm.
you know, like this is the action we should take, and this is why we should take it, mm-hmm. and those are things we can have meaningful conversations about. And if they were entirely relative or entirely subjective,
mm-hmm.
we couldn't have those meaningful conversations.
Right,
like they would end immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, weirdly enough, I think it was Ken Wilber. I'll put a link. I'm sure that I can find something about Ken Wilber online, but who introduced me to the concept of intersubjectivity and the idea that there are facts that don't exist independently of human beings, but that are nonetheless facts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, sociological facts. A lot of sociological facts are. They're intersubjective facts.
Mm-hmm.
So we can look at something like our crime rate, for mm-hmm. example,
mm-hmm.
and we can see that the crime rate has been progressively getting lower,
mm-hmm.
And that is an empirical fact.
Yeah,
based on the criteria that we set out for what constitutes crime and et cetera, like there's a whole bunch of interestingly complicated parameters that go into that, but ultimately it's sort of a qualitative fact.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the crime rate going down is good is an intersubjective fact. It's a thing that we understand
mm-hmm.
to be true,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't like sit down and observe that in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We understand it to be true because it exists relationally between all of us. It means not just that people are less likely to be the victims of crimes, but it also tells us, for example, that people feel less motivated to commit crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us the opportunity to have additional conversations. Like, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
Are our draconian policing procedures finally working? Or have we adopted different societal models?
Mm-hmm.
And so we get into intersubjective facts of morality, and it becomes pretty easy to recognize a bunch of, like, reasonably... I don't like to use the term universal things. I wrote about it in my thesis as best practices,
mm-hmm.
with the idea that I wanted it to be able to fit whatever motivational model you had. Like, if you were a virtue ethicist, you can come up with best practices based on
mm-hmm.
your you know, your the virtues that you embrace. If you're a consequentialist and what you care about is good outcomes, mm-hmm. you can develop best practices that create good outcomes. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we can compare practices mm-hmm. and have a conversation about those, mm-hmm. about which ones are better and why. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of where I wanted to get my hands on. So I spent a lot of time talking about stakeholders and who's a stakeholder in a decision and why. And I've got a bunch of posts on Concept Crucible about it. I'll throw the links in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Rather than rehashing it all here. But, I mean, essentially anyone who's in a position to be respected by a choice that you make or disrespected by a choice that you make is a stakeholder mm-hmm. and deserves consideration. And we can see that in all kinds of weird positions. Mm-hmm. And I don't think about it in that way all the time. I think because I've internalized a lot of that. Because I spent so much time doing it. But, like, for somebody who... Like, as somebody who spends a bunch of time sort of working on their empathy, and especially, like as somebody who grew up without a really strong... you know, sense of it, I find it really helpful to think about ethics and action independent of the need for empathy. Mm-hmm. Like, regardless of how I am feeling or regardless of how I feel towards somebody, if they are a stakeholder, I understand that there are certain things that should be done. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's really important to me, because sometimes I'm not in the right headspace to make a good choice about that. Mm-hmm. I need that strategy, I need that plan to exist independent of my headspace. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like my current ethics are nuanced. Shockingly, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. But at the same time, they're deeply geared toward the like idiosyncrasies of being me every day. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's reasonably important for anybody, is that, I mean, humanity is diverse. Mm-hmm. And frameworks and situations are going to be diverse. And it is weird to think that we could develop a set of rules that applies in all situations at all times. Mm-hmm. But it is reasonable to think that we could develop and talk about good sets of things that we do. I mean, I think that it is better to do good things for good reasons, mm-hmm. but if we cannot do good things for good reasons, let us at least do good things. Mm-hmm. You inspired?
I suppose, but mine's not going to be nearly as wonderful and eloquent.
Oh, God.
I guess it kind of piggybacking on the idea that I'm now out of school and having to be my own person and whatnot, I suppose my sense of morality is influenced in a couple different ways. Recognizing and accepting that I am not an island, that I am a part of an interconnected community, whether that is my immediate community of where I live, whether that's my town, whether that's my workplace community. And so I fit within it, and I'm not just a lone wolf. And I'm not saying that I was always that way, but it's kind of becoming more mindful of how the way I take up any kind of space interacts with other kinds of people. Mm. So personal senses of responsibility in that regard.
That's the virtue of mindfulness.
The virtue of mindfulness. And the kind of old man huckle coming out when other people are less considerate, you know, the people who drive erratically on the road, you know, it's important to abide by the traffic laws because it helps keep order and everybody predictable on the road. But, you know, stewardship of my environment, both in the kind of natural sense that I pick up dog crap, or I should say I pick up my dog's crap. I don't go around and picking up other people's dog poop, but I realize that, you know, cleaning up after my dog so that other people can enjoy the space, trying not to be too intrusive on other people's enjoyment of things, learning to that my expressing my opinion is not always important, desirable, or needed.
Mm.
And keeping my mouth...
I'm still trying to learn that.
Yeah, well, it's probably because you're ever so slightly more enlightened than I am. But I find that I value my relationship with other people significantly more than valuing needing to say something at a time. And a lot of times it comes to be true that perhaps I was wrong about it. And it's better that I not alienate people that I care about for the sake of trying to work out things outside of my headspace.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I might disagree with my friends. Like, diametrically, I might disagree with my friends on a position. And whether or not I end up changing my mind or something else comes of it is not necessarily all that important, but preserving friendships and preserving those relationships are more important to me. So, yeah, I'm not really... It's not a really grand sweeping thing. It's just my... I guess...
it just governs every action every day.
I guess, yeah. Okay, so it's incredibly important. But like I said, like when I started off this part of the conversation, you know, it really started to come into its own in the last, say, 5 years. You know, since coming out of grad school and having to deal with a wider diversity of people, both online and in meet space, that mm-hmm. Contextual and case sensitive living has become something that guides me more often. And I care about things that I normally wouldn't care about, or I let things go that I find is not important for me to follow up on. And I know a lot of this is super, super vague. Like when I go back and I'm going to listen to this, especially when it comes to editing, I'm going to be like, yeah, you were not talking about anything in particular, were you? But it's really hard to nail it down without going into specific case examples. I guess...
Such is the problem of virtue ethics.
I guess is virtue ethics and just kind of ethics in general, that when you don't apply it to specific cases, it's just a nice wishy-washy rule. But I would say, like, if I had to comment on my current state of morality or the current state in which I try to live a good life, those are the kinds of things that are most pressing or most influencing of how I negotiate those kind of turbulent waters.
Fair. Yeah, so you mentioned sort of, you know, having like more diverse relationships
mm-hmm.
as being a big cause in that sort of shift from, you know, being an island
mm-hmm.
and being a lone operator
mm-hmm.
to you know, taking into account things like contextuality. Different cases, different like systems of oppression, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Intersectionality. I don't know. We'll throw a link to the SEP page on intersectionality down below.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there is one.
Mm-hmm.
If not, I'll find a better resource.
Mm-hmm.
But what are some other things that you think have caused those shifts?
I mean, the immediate ones in my life is very. I'm going to just say strong people in my life. The very people who care very passionately about these things. Again, because I care about them first rather than being right, and I guess this is perhaps a flaw of myself, but it's a flaw that I accept that because I care about them, I'm more likely to listen to them or I'm more likely to give them my attention
mm-hmm.
because I want to preserve that relationship. So, I mean, there is that element of it that I guess, like, we've had AY on the show. Because I'm friends with AY first, I'm more likely to keep my mouth shut and just listen and learn something from that. And I'm not going to say specifics of how things have shifted over time, but I can say that my worldview has altered significantly from it was, say, 5 years ago before I started. Because I interacted with AY first in... Was I in grad school and she was an undergrad? I think so. But regardless, like, I'm a different person now, and I can say with confidence that I'm a different person in part because of how our relationship has come about.
Fair. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other catalysts, like, for change. I mean, like, for me, I have definitely undergone some pretty... dramatic ethical changes in the course of my life. Some of that has to do with people and people that I know and people that I'm influenced by. Some of that has to do, I think, with, I mean, just perspective, like acquiring a wider perspective and acquiring distance from, my brain just completely left my body. It's now somewhere else entirely. But no, acquiring distance from in some ways the person that I used to be, who was a kid who I don't know, I don't remember, can't say with authority whether or not I was like I had bad motivations, but I had a lot of behavior problems, and I've talked about that before in the I think the character podcast. But I think the one of the biggest ones for me is noticing gaps. And this has definitely been true in the past, I want to say, five to 7 years, where I will find a gap in my empathy, in my care, in my mindfulness, in my ability to imagine what the right thing actually is. And whenever, and I think that that's not uncommon. I think that we encounter those kinds of gaps all the time. Mm-hmm. Whether it's an unfamiliar situation, whether it's an unfamiliar conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think every time that we encounter those, we have to make a choice about where we stand on that. Like, do we double down and say, okay, well, no. I'm already doing all the right things. And I think that I have an advantage, and this will maybe sound a little silly, but I think I have an advantage in that I have spent a bunch of time doing the wrong things. And I hope become more willing to entertain that, like, in that moment I am probably still doing the wrong thing, and it is worth considering the, you know, other alternatives. It is worth like looking at that as a gap, mm-hmm. being like, if this is a gap, how do I do it? I always talk about the constant studies of video games that show that video games don't actually like make you violent or damage your empathy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do. I mean, there's a bunch of like violent sensitivity stuff in media in general, but video games don't specifically contribute to that any more than television. And I find that really interesting. I mean, I play a lot of video games. We have a lot of conversations about, you know, whether or not it is responsible to let children play video games. But the flip side of that, I think, is, and the bit that we don't talk about, is that means that I play a lot of video games, and when I find gaps in my empathy, they're not there because video games put them there, but they are still there. And they need to be dealt with. Hmm. And we find ourselves in this state, or at least I do, of imagining the person that we can be, the person that we want to be, mm-hmm. and shuffling forward into that person's shoes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're going to talk about it a little bit, I believe, in a different podcast about books, but you know, in the last year I started reading more, and I think part of that was motivated by I wasn't happy where I was, you know, career, life, and whatnot, but I had imagined where I wanted to be or the kind of person that I wanted to be, and my reading was intentionally meant to try to bring me closer to that realization of the person that I wanted to be. And I think sometimes that kind of introspective reflection can also be an impetus towards, you know, making a kind of moral or ethical change about yourself. Yeah. I mean, I read a lot of douchey self-help books, but I think in the last year I've also become a better person through some combination.
I always think of there's a line from Ms. Marvel, the new Ms. Marvel, which is super good, and I've almost certainly quoted it on the podcast before. I can't read that page without like tearing up, where she's sitting in her room. And she says, good isn't a thing you are. It's a thing you do. And, I mean, the thing with ethics is it can't just be ideas. It has to be action. It has to inform actual decisions in the world, or it isn't worth shit. Which I guess is one of the things I like. I really enjoy about it, is that if you want something in philosophy that affects the real world, I mean, there's lots of different ways to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no surer way than working in ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. That got real. So yeah, you can find us on, if you want to talk about ethics or various quandaries or stump me with ethical dilemmas or a million other things, you can tweet us at Wootsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Find us on Facebook or Instagram at Wootsuit Riot.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to support the podcast, you can also do that. The podcast, as well as our co-op adventures and our musical endeavors and all the other things that we do on our channel, you can go to our Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
Links are all down there in the show notes. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much. And let us know as well where your origins and ethics have come
from.
We want to hear your stories.
Always.
Always.
Oh, anyway, I'm Jim.
I'm Ryan.
We're signing off.
Stay awesome. Now, just sit back down for a second, because this is a forced funny moment.
Okay.
Can you say that Miss Marvel quote again?
Good isn't a thing you are, it's a thing you do.
Aristotle!
Fuck you.
Virtue ethics.
That's not true at all.